You're listening to a podcast from the University of Warwick. Recently, colleagues from Boston University visited the Warwick campus as part of a joint workshop in complexity science. In this podcast, I talk with members of the health workshop about their discussions on healthcare. Taking part were Dr. Francis Griffiths, Professor Jonathan Cave, and Associate Professor Yasmin Morali, all from Warwick University. They were joined by Professor Alan Cohen from Boston University.
Over the last couple of days, there's been a lot of discussions going on between academics from Boston and Warwick, looking at various elements around policy and the development of ideas around a number of themes, including energy. But more specifically, you've been sort of talking around some of the issues looking in terms of medicine and health policy. Francis, do you want to just give me an overview of the kind of themes that have emerged over the last couple of days?
Well, when we went into the workshop, we really weren't quite sure what themes would emerge, although we were aware of each other's interests. And in the course of the discussion, this was with the people who were interested in health, along with the complexity scientists. The idea of looking at continuity of care came out, partly because of the very different health care provision in the US and the UK. Looking at it maybe in a way that neither the US nor the UK have looked at it before.
Alan, it's evident from the past couple of administrations that policymakers in the US have really struggled to get to grips with healthcare as an issue in the US. What are the discussions around that you've had over the last couple of days? How has that kind of informed some of your thinking about health systems and health policy in the US?
Well, it's a little early to evaluate, but I'm very encouraged by the interactions over the last few days. I think one of the major advantages of the collaboration between BU and Warwick will be that, as Francis had said, we can look at how complexity science might help us in the United States solve some of the intractable problems that have resisted solution by more conventional statistical methods of analysis. I also feel that there's a lot of cross-learning taking place, and the discussions over the last 2 days in the workshop definitely pointed that out. So while we may focus at first on this continuity of care project, there actually were several other ideas that were placed on the table for consideration, and I fully expect that they will come to fruition as well.
Do you want to explain a little bit more about the continuity of care project and what was encompassed as part of that?
I'll start, and Francis can chime in. In the United States at present, there's a great deal of concern over whether or not patients receive continuous care. Continuous in the sense that if they have particular medical problems or they have chronic illnesses, that they can go to a usual or regular source of care. Because we have so many uninsured individuals, because there are many other barriers that prevent access to that type of care, there has been growing interest in a model known as the medical home. We discovered when we came here to work that the medical home is in fact the GP model that has been at work here in the UK. And although I know that there are some concerns about how well that works and it's considered to be imperfect, it nevertheless is a model from which we may be able to learn something. So what we plan to do is analyze what has in fact been done in the UK and what has been done to date in the United States. We will compare those, and we will look for opportunities to analyze the factors that may identify potential policy solutions to the problems that each country faces. So again, this is an instance of potential cross-learning.
Mm. Well, in the UK, we've always had an emphasis on continuity of care through the general practice. But that's been much in debate and maybe changing. And I think having a comparison of the US, where there is that will take a different perspective on what continuity is, we might actually discover that we need to place the continuity in a different part of the system. It may even be with the patient, or it may be with the physician, or it may be at a different point. And that question really came out of the discussion. Okay, where is the continuity at what point? And where are the decisions best made?
And what are the elements of complexity science that you hope may help shape the overall response to those challenges?
Can I jump in on this? One of the aspects of complexity science is that complexity involves, but as a matter of definition, linking up separate systems and seeing how the overall system behaves. So the healthcare system is, by definition, at least one, and generally many, complex systems. So if we take something like continuity, one element of continuity is how does the complex healthcare delivery system provide continuity of care to the patients. The patients are embedded in communities, and each patient is themselves a complex system. Some of the bits that are joined up are the patient with one condition, that same patient with another condition, simultaneously or in future. The way patients, in other words, engage with their conditions is part of the way that complex response happens, and it's known sometimes as patient empowerment or engagement. If you want to have efficiency of overall healthcare delivery, you need to have planning and strategy that mobilizes and uses this concept of empowerment. The patient has to be able to communicate to the healthcare system what they know and what their preferences are, and to receive knowledge and guidance that they can understand and will comply with. And so the first thing that comes out of that is that you have continuity in terms of the patient as a complex system receiving continuous or coherent inputs. You also have continuity on the medical side, that when a doctor sees a patient, it's not, I mean, when Alan said about not having uninsured people, the tagline that comes to mind is that whether you are poor or whether you have complex conditions in a highly fragmented system, you have no fixed medical abode. And that concept of abode, of having a fixity as a point of continuity, is very important. It could be a hospital, it could be a patient. And so to make sure that the evolution of these two sides of the patient-provider divide remains coherent or moves in a positive direction, I think the complexity motif and the particular element of what's called emergent behavior is very important. So the two things that we normally associate with complex systems are that things happen at the system level that were not understood or seen at the micro level. It couldn't be planned for and can't be managed. And sometimes these things are enormously powerful and good, and sometimes they're perverse and bad. And the other one is synchronization. We have all these little bits. A patient is like another patient, particularly from the perspective of the healthcare system. When they all begin to behave in the same way, then you somehow need to take that into account. So treating flu symptoms is very different if it's just an ordinary scattered flu than if it is the leading edge of an epidemic. You need to be able to recognize that and take that into account.
I may add one other thing. In addition to what Jonathan said about both the patient's perspective and the provider's perspective in continuity, there's a third element that we discussed in this workshop, and it had to do with the continuity of the medical record or information system. And this is an area that Yasmin knows a good deal about. But in our country, we have a disjointed information system now where many hospitals and physician practices do not have electronic medical record systems. And so the question of a medical abode to which a patient can go, one important aspect of that is making certain that the information that's important, the medical history, all of the other clinical information regarding that patient's welfare, is in place so that a provider, even if it's not the same physician, can access that information and provide continuous care to the individual.
And that's interesting because in England, we've actually got quite a strong focus on using information technology to allow this continuity and access to relevant information wherever you happen to be within the system. But one of the kind of other issues around this is perhaps we're placing too much of an emphasis on that kind of technology fix, because at the end of the day, we're also talking on both sides of the wash about this notion of patient-centred treatment and the right of people to make decisions about what they're doing. So if you have that, then it brings another interesting question that we haven't addressed here, but we were talking about quite a lot within the workshop, which is where does that information sit and where is the right of making decisions sit, and how do you ensure that people have enough information to make relevant decisions? But also in the past, we've always relied on the practitioner to tell us what is right for us or what is good for us. And if we start moving away, as we are in the UK, from the very kind of cosy doctor-patient relationship, so he's known when you were born and he's easy from birth to death and so on, and we rely more on information to allow you to give you that continuity, what we're missing out on is the trust aspect of it. So this is something that I think will be very important. And it kind of comes back to something else we talked about very much, which was social networks and social infrastructure in. But just one more thing before I kind of stop talking about that piece is that in terms of continuity, we focus very much as well on health. But if we're thinking about this lifetime thing, then we have this issue here where we're saying we want joined up delivery for patient quality of life. And that means the social services and the health services have to work together. So again, that's an issue because you need to figure out how they come together seamlessly as the rhetoric goes. But how do you manage information sharing between those, given all the kinds of things we've had in the news recently about privacy protection, the right to share information across boundaries and so on. And so it gives you an idea about how much there is to unpack, unfold and deal with behind these ideas. But the final thing I want to just add to what Jonathan said about complexity and where does it come in is that what we're looking at quite often is this kind of dynamic system where people are passing through a system where you have different providers coming in to deal with them. So you have a network of sorts. But what you're trying to do with what you do with policy is actually looking for those networks to evolve over time. So it's capturing that dynamic aspect, making decisions about what might be needed in the future because you're doing intervention now, but knowing that whatever intervention you do now will actually change the system you're dealing with. So the emergence aspect Jonathan talked about becomes very important there. And the final point I want to make is about policy in the UK. We cannot afford to deliver what people expect with the top-down models. So this kind of distributed model really matters. And the patient-centred things that people were talking about and that we'll probably discuss a bit more in this conversation really start to matter because you want to be able to draw on the patient's resources and their decision about what they need out of life rather than try and do the ideal.
One of the complications, of course, is that almost by definition a patient is in some way vulnerable and therefore is not necessarily in a position to actually garner all the support and information that they actually need to make decisions. So this idea of how they are embedded within their social network becomes rather important if decision-making is going to be at the level of the patient.
There is a further point, which is that the doctors themselves have certain vulnerabilities. And we've seen, particularly in the United States, and this is one of the fertilizing aspects of this transatlantic collaboration, which is that the presence of, for example, legal liability, or the presence of liability created either by what you have done or by what you have done compared to some standard in the literature, some marketing to the patient, something you won't necessarily have seen, has changed the geometry of the system. It certainly radically changed, as Alan told us, the balance between specialists and primary care physicians, as we would call them here. And because they perform different functions, the primary care physician is a home, it is a center of trust. And that trust is based on a sense of shared agency, right? If you've known the patient for a long time, your interests and theirs become identified, and the only problem you have to worry about is a sort of coordination problem. But if you're seeing this patient on referral and you're going to do something to or for them and they're going to go away, you need some other form of structure. But at that point, if, for example, you make a medical record about a patient and that record is incorrect, for instance, then you may suffer some liability, which means that if somebody relies on the system as being an accurate, medically defined record of everything that's happened to the patient, but if it's censored by these incentives built in due to things working on the patient side, then it doesn't necessarily work very well. And the other thing that's critically important in that, because it's to do with compliance, in this case on the physician side, are the social networks taking place among doctors or between doctors and administrators. And here, too, there's been a lot of very interesting experience in the United States just to see how medical knowledge bubbles up from clinical practice, comes down from the peer-reviewed literature, and diffuses or doesn't diffuse through the rest of the system where it can be applied and refined.
This is a particularly exciting time for this collaboration to take place because, as you know, the United States is in the throes of a very contentious debate over healthcare reform. While it's unclear what form that reform will take ultimately, even if it comes reasonably close to what President Obama has in mind, it will bode well for models such as the medical home. And so the work that we may be doing may be very policy relevant to the future of the United States, and with particular emphasis on improving the continuity of care as we make changes in how we deliver care to individuals, how we cover them through various insurance options, and how we control healthcare spending. And this is where complexity science and its application to healthcare, I think, becomes extremely important. So not only will we learn from the experiences here in the UK, but there may be a golden opportunity for us to work together on things that will hopefully lead the way for the US healthcare system as reform is implemented over the coming years.
Could I ask a question? It just struck me. I mean, I was thinking about the basis for this collaboration. One thing being that we use different bits of theory, and those are driven in some to some extent, particularly in their applications, by the different institutional contexts, right? They're different worlds, so we invent different kinds of theory. We collect different kinds of data, and we consider different forms of institution. My impression in Britain has been that innovation has been a series of top-down things, what's been called initiativitis, that as with education, the configuration of these things as large, unified, monolithic public services has meant that there is a lever there to fix things on a political timescale. So before they've bedded in and you can properly evaluate their complex effects, you're on to the next one. That chokes off a kind of bottom-up innovation we would hope to see. If, on the other hand, the US does it much less often and much more systemically, precisely because their reach is more attenuated by the fact that it's, you know, permeated by the private sector and so on, we can learn something about the dynamics of policy reform, which completes the complexity of the system by putting in the political super system or the market super system. Would that be a fair...
That is a very interesting observation. Traditionally, in the United States, in our healthcare system, we have relied on small-scale innovation, usually characterized as grassroots or bottom-up. And if one could demonstrate the comparative advantage of that new product or service or whatever, or technology, whatever the case may be, more likely than not, it would begin to diffuse. But we've never really attempted such large-scale social innovation, except in the instance of the creation of the Medicare and Medicaid programs in 1965, and some would argue even more recently that the changes made in 2003, which introduced a prescription drug benefit to the Medicare program, was a relatively large social innovation. But nothing on the order of magnitude that President Obama and his advisors now contemplate. So this is really, I think, a watershed moment for American healthcare. And what I find particularly interesting about complexity science is the systems thinking approach that it brings to this. We in America have not really thought at the systems level as much as we probably should. And that's because some of us question whether or not our healthcare system is indeed, quote, a system. So we're now beginning to see some of the connections among the different organizations and institutions and players within the system. But I think we have the opportunity now to take it another step beyond that. And especially if reform goes in a particular direction, we may have an opportunity to make important contributions.
Well, the scale and scope requires it, right?
Yes,
because
it would.
You can get by with local thinking when you're doing local reform or limited reform. I was just thinking about markets, right? Using markets. In a market, it's enough if each person looks to their own
What I was going to say is, listening to what you were saying, is what we do in the NHS, top-down change, results in local innovation in order to keep the thing stable and delivering.
Reactive innovation.
Yeah, reactive innovation. It's we'll have to change it in this way to carry on providing what we consider reasonable care, despite the change.
So that requires something else of the complex system, which is the adaptiveness of the parts to changes coming from the whole.
Yes.
And that's what a characteristic of social complex systems that you don't always find in natural complex systems.
One aspect of the adaptation is that one would expect that in a top-down diffusion approach, there should be the flexibility to adapt the model, because one size does not fit all. So as you try to implement policy, very often there have to be policy reactions to that at local levels in order to make it work.
Mm-hmm. I just have one more thing. You know, with American advantage, I think what you might have is, because you've allowed these things to grow independently of each other, what you might have the advantage of is a diversity of models that will actually allow you to think about all the different possibles that you need to cater for. Because I think one of the problems we have in the UK quite often with policymaking is it is too constraining. So it's too specific because we are doing one size fits all. Whereas you are going to be forced to have something that actually gives you more room to accommodate the differences, which may actually give you a more robust system because you have that much diversity built into it.
That philosophy is known as let 1,000 flowers bloom.
Chairman Mao. But
would we want to go that far?
But in Francis's view, if we have these reactive innovations, the problem is that you never get to see across the field at the other flowers. They happen locally, and so they're not joined up at the periphery.
Yeah, but I think if you kind of go back to the complex systems type of thinking, then that's perfectly fine because what you're doing is you're getting local adjustment to local circumstances, and because everybody is doing it, and because we are a system in the sense that we can't be totally disconnected at the bottom from the other bits.
But it's a star rather than a cluster, and it converges much more slowly to its equilibrium.
But that's assuming that you want convergence equilibrium, because I think one of the nice things about complex systems is adaptive equilibrium systems.
It's also assumed that you are adequately evaluating all of the diversity of adaptations and innovations. If you're not, then you're losing a great amount of information, and unfortunately it's probably true in our country, and I can't speak for the UK, but in our country we have allowed these 1,000 flowers to bloom, but we very often have not looked carefully or understood what their effects were and what the potential benefits and risks might be, and that's a missed opportunity.
But being forced to systemic thinking will now actually give you that chance to say, okay, how do you exploit the diversity?
Yes.